Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me today is Beth Bismeyer.
Hello, Beth.
Beth is a friend of mine going way back, but she has worked as an organizer in Kentucky in many different capacities and is currently a social worker, just finished social work school. So congratulations, Beth, on that.
Thank you.
Your award is that you get to come on the podcast, I guess.
Yes.
So there you go. Yeah, so we're excited to have Beth joining us today. We're going to talk a lot about the JCPS takeover by the Kentucky Board of Education. So there's been some developments in that story. We're going to talk about those. And also we're going to talk about the Social Work Apprentice Program, which is put in place by the Bevin administration. You know, we're going to take advantage of Beth's expertise while she's here. We also have quick hits. And after that, we have an interview with two members of the Kentucky chapter of the Poor People's Campaign. We were really excited to record that interview, and we think it went really well. So I hope you enjoy it too. But without any further ado, let's get started on the JCPS takeover. All right, Beth, are you ready for this?
As ready as I'm going to be.
All right, that'll work. Okay, on May 29th, which was just yesterday, we're recording this. Today is May 30th when we're recording this. On May 29th, the JCPS school board unsurprisingly decided to fight this state takeover that had been proposed by the State Board of Education. You know, hopefully you've been following the story at least a little bit. Over the past couple of months, the chair of the State Board of Education changed, the executive director of the organization changed, and they voted for a takeover of JCPS, which would be put in place by the State Board of Education. Yesterday, JCPS made the decision to fight that. So today, May 30th, is actually the last day that an appeal could have been filed at all. The reason it probably took so long for JCPS to file the appeal was because of time. Once an appeal is filed, the law says that a hearing has to be held 20 days after. An interesting fact is the contract between JCPS teachers and the district expires on June 30th, which is 31 days from now. So that buys them time to finish a contract and get it in place. So it seems like some tricky stuff that's going on. Yeah. So, you know, by waiting for an appeal and triggering the waiting period later, it elongates the time that they're actually in charge. If the labor contract is actually signed before the takeover can be made official, there will be probably some fireworks. I think if the takeover happens and a new contract is in place, Wayne Lewis and the Kentucky Board of Education will actually probably work to nullify it.
And one quick thing about that, that'll be interesting to see what happens there, because I did see where in a rally yesterday, the JCTA president, Brent McKim, I believe was saying how just like with any contract, it has to be honored. So he's already, sounds like, trying to be proactive and trying to stop anything that might come from Lewis to try to counteract their contract there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all about positioning. I think he's definitely saying, you know, you have to honor the contracts that you sign. Of course, I'm sure that Mr. Lewis sees it a different way. That this is definitely shaping up to be a big fight in the near future. Okay, so the state itself has taken over five different school districts, and two of those takeovers are actually still ongoing. At least one of those takeovers was appealed. And the Courier-Journal, they laid out the process of the appeal in an article by Darcy Costello yesterday, the 29th. Essentially, the process is that an open hearing is held at the Kentucky Department of Education, which is overseen by a hearing officer from the Attorney General's office. And it operates a lot like a trial. There's witnesses and evidence that can be presented, and somebody makes a decision as to whether or not the appeal has merit and is reversed. Anybody who's interested in this issue, they really ought to listen to WFPL's Curious Louisville episode about the takeover on JCPS. It's about 45 minutes long. It's a really great explanation of several of the big questions hanging over the situation. Did you get a chance to listen to it, Beth?
I got to listen to part of it in the car recently and need to go listen to the rest. I really appreciate everything that Curious Louisville has done and really like that they focused in on this issue, because there are tons of questions surrounding it. It's hard to get it all straight.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I was driving and kept listening to it. I had to stop and get gas, and it was kind of like I was just sitting in my car, like, listening to the answers, and I was like, I got to turn it off and fill my tank up. But yeah, definitely go back and listen to that if you get a chance. Everybody listening, and Beth too. Okay, let's be totally honest, though. Appealing directly to the agency that voted for you to be taken over is a losing proposition. It's going to be difficult to get the group that you just appealed to be like, oh, yeah, totally, we were wrong, my bad. If the appeal, though, is denied, there is the prospect of what's called judicial review. This is where we need Jasmine to talk to us about the law.
Yes.
Judicial review means that all agency decisions, they can be appealed directly to the circuit court. In my mind, this is likely where it's heading. There will be an appeal 20 days from now. There will be a huge trial. Things will happen. There will be a signed contract at some point in the middle of that. And then the appeal will likely be denied. And then it will end up in circuit court. If the decision does end up in a courtroom, a judge can actually block the takeover from taking place while the appeal is decided. That would mean even more time for JCPS to be in charge. However, it is not guaranteed that a stay would be granted. It would actually be in the hands of the judge. So the review in circuit court would either take place in Franklin Circuit Court or in Jefferson Circuit Court, which is probably favorable for JCPS. We've talked about all the judges in Fayette Circuit Court who are often annoying and needling Matt Bevin by ruling against him in his lawsuits. In Jefferson Circuit Court, most of the judges that are elected are probably more progressive than in the other parts of the state. Well-organized judicial elections in Louisville. So, Beth, you talked about looking at the scene outside the JCPS meeting yesterday. It was pretty wild, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's just a huge crowd there, lots of teachers, lots of parents, lots of staff, and just community folks who maybe they don't even have a kid in schools, but just really value our public school system here and wanting to show support.
Yeah, it seemed like that most people were wearing red, which is, I guess, mm-hmm. the thing that they're doing, and they were holding up these signs that said hashtag mm-hmm. our JCPS, which is a new coalition with the support of NEA, which is the nation's biggest teachers union. As an aside, you know, I wasn't there, but I did get to look at a bunch of pictures. There were 27 pictures from the Courier Journal that went along with the article that they posted. And I think I probably saw like 5 men in a crowd of several hundred. So women were really showing out yesterday.
They were. But to the credit of men, I did watch the video that the Courier Journal posted on their page. And there were a lot more men than 5, okay. including there were a number of state house representatives and uh-huh. I think you also might have seen there was a clip of Metro Council President David James getting the crowd fired up in a series of chants. But that is for sure that women were definitely the vast majority of folks there. So
yeah, and a lot of
everybody needs to step up.
Yeah, definitely. There were a lot of people running for the House of Representatives. I saw Tina Bojnarowski post a picture of like 5 women who are running for the state House of Representatives, which is really cool to see.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like that everybody's kind of itching for a fight, and I think they're going to get one around this issue. It seems like this is headed to an appeal. There will be lots of people covering that. We will certainly be talking about that, and wherever it ends up, if it ends with the appeal or if it ends up in court, we will certainly be there to cover it all as it happens. So pretty wild.
Yeah, and one quick note, something that just came up right before we sat down here, is that the chief attorney for the Kentucky Department of Education resigned just today. So Kevin C. Brown, the associate commissioner and general counsel for the Department of Education, resigned Tuesday. His final day was today, apparently.
Huh.
It'll just be interesting to see. The spokesperson for the Department of Education did not say why he resigned. She said that his departure should not affect the upcoming JCPS hearing, but he is someone who would have been very involved in defending the Department of Education's stance.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it'll be curious to know more. Maybe we'll learn from him. Maybe we won't as to why he left. But it's hard to not imagine that it couldn't be connected.
Yeah, definitely. Especially since he resigned and then was gone the very next day.
Yeah.
And the fact that they didn't come out immediately and say, this wasn't to do with JCPS takeover. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like if that was the case, they would have said that. So, yeah, maybe he'll get called as a witness for the trial.
Yeah, so just curious developments.
Yeah, we will see. We will see. All right, we are taking advantage of Beth being on the show today by talking about the social work apprenticeship, which is being put in place by the Bevin administration. So this actually is a story that happened a few weeks ago. The Bevin administration announced this program. It's a social work apprentice program they build as the first of its kind. Essentially, the program offers paid opportunities within the local protection and permanency and family support offices, which is they exist within the Department of Community-Based Services. Beth, do all social work jobs involve like so many different words and things being shoved together like that?
There's a lot there, and we can get into a little bit more later, but this is more social services. You uh-huh. could be a social worker. You might not have to be a social worker to be in here. So there's just more to go into after you do okay. your little spiel.
For sure. So apprentices who are in the program, they have to complete 144 hours of instruction in the classroom and 2,000 to 3,000 on-the-job hours in order to complete the program. So apprenticeship programs like these are for workers who do not have like an educational background in social work. The program's supposed to provide that kind of training, the training that's necessary for workers to do this job. The program is said to be targeting people impacted by generational poverty as potential applicants to the program. They said that the program would be available to high school students, mid-career professionals, and college students. And apprentices can choose between three positions: office management, social services, and family services, which I think is what you were saying specifically. It's not necessarily social work as much as it's just like work around social work, right?
Yeah, and that's something that I'd like to have some more clarity on when it comes to this program. Some people equate social work as social services, and someone could be a social worker doing social services. But we think of, at least, you know, just speaking for myself, when I think of social services, I think more of the public assistance programs, of mm-hmm. SNAP, of some of that direct frontline kind of work in providing services to people. Mm-hmm. Whereas a social worker can do so many different things. You know, you can be at the micro level doing that direct client contact work. You can also have macro social work, which is really looking at policy change, looking at bigger systems. So there are a lot of questions around this as to, you know, they're saying it's social work, but there's actually a KRS statute that says you have to be licensed in order to be considered a social worker in the
right.
state. I'm actually more of a pending social worker because I'm waiting for the state board to, to process my license.
That sounds terrifying.
Get to work. Yeah, so I passed the certified social worker exam, and that's the master's level social work licensing. So there are just lots of questions, and I think I might have jumped ahead there, but
right.
But yeah, social work and social services aren't necessarily the same thing. And so there's some confusion amongst
right.
social workers in the state as to what exactly do they mean.
What's
and how are they defining social services.
Yeah, seems like they could have put a little bit more thought into it, maybe.
Yeah, there's the National Association of Social Work is the national professional member organization. And the Kentucky chapter, when they shared about this announcement, they said, this is totally news to us, which is not a great sign.
No.
So it's not clear that anyone who's actually a social worker was a part of any conversation. We have the Council for Social Work Education has a number of accredited programs here in the state. Like I went to the Kent School at the University of Louisville. UK also has a program.
Mm-hmm.
Not clear that any of them were consulted. So there's just a lot of questions and concerns as to what does this entail and what will the expectations be of these folks who go through this program.
Right.
Yeah, lots of questions.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it says like the positions are like office management, social services, and family services. That's like every worker in the entire world too. So
yeah,
like, yeah, that's kind of interesting.
It's pretty vague.
So yeah, I mean the reason that the program was put in place though is you know, social workers who work directly for the state, they've kind of been a go-to example for a long time of state workers who are overworked and underpaid. The last information that I saw, and it's probably been updated, but the last information that I saw was from 2014, and it said that 50% of social workers in Northern Kentucky and 20% of Louisville social workers turned over in a single year. So mm-hmm. half the people that had that job in Northern Kentucky quit and had to have new people come in to fill their spots in 1 year. The most recent budget, and this is something we've talked about at length during the budget season, the most recent budget passed by the Bevin administration actually did increase pay for social workers. So getting people to fill those slots is very key. A well-run apprentice program could potentially help to solve that problem. But, you know, I don't know. That is kind of an interesting question. It is kind of like, does the increase in salary, would it mean more people wanting to fill these positions, or do they have enough trouble filling them already? What's your sense coming out of, and I guess starting out in the field, starting to look for jobs, are they just like falling out of the trees and go work wherever you want, or is it harder to find than we may think?
So with a social work degree, there's so many different things you can do. And my specialization and interest is actually in palliative and hospice care. So that limits a bit more as to what I'm looking mm-hmm. for. But again, people could do, lots of social workers are in nonprofit settings. Some are in hospital settings, mm-hmm. many in school settings, and some in government. So there's just a wide range of what people can do. So in terms of filling these positions, I'm curious how this apprentice program could work and be effective. When in the press conference, when it was announced, Derek Ramsey, who's now in a different position, which we'll get to later, but in his position at that time, a reporter asked, you know, is there a job guarantee at the end of this program? And he said, no, but if you do a good job, we're likely to hire you. There's going to be a job there. And it's just not clear exactly how long the program lasts for. And I just have a lot of concerns, like I said earlier, as to what the roles of these apprentices will be, you know, especially because they mentioned that high school juniors and seniors could start engaging in this.
Right.
And, you know, so there could potentially be a 17-year-old who, depending on what kind of work there is, are they working directly with clients? Are they working with families in crisis? You know, that's a lot for someone who even has gone through master's level and gone through licensing and lots of experience. You know, they're still vulnerable to experiencing trauma and burnout. So I just worry about what are we exposing these, you know, potentially teenagers to if they're doing this direct client contact work. And then also, what are we putting on the families and the people they're working with? You know, someone might not feel too good if they're like, wait, why is a teenager helping me with this?
Right.
So there are just lots of things to consider. Again, it seems like, from my understanding, not many social workers were actually engaged in discussing this process. So the National Association for Social Work Kentucky chapter, they did share that they reached out to the DCBS commissioner and have a meeting planned and have invited some other professional social work organizations in the state. So hopefully they get some answers out of there, but there's just been a lot of confusion. It's like, where's this funding coming from?
Right.
How long is it going for? How long does the program last? Because they say how many hours you would need to complete the program, but over how many years is that? So I just still have a lot of questions. You know, I do applaud the idea of reaching out to young people and giving them some opportunity to see, is this a field you would be interested in? Because we know that education is expensive, and taking out those student loans, if you're not sure that's what you want to do, that's a pretty scary, daunting thing.
Yeah.
But it just seems like there needs to be some more thought and more collaboration, really, to work on something like this.
Yeah, you're hitting a lot of the big problems with a lot of Bevin administration programs, I think, which is maybe key to notice here. It's like, not a lot of stakeholder management, not a lot of stakeholder engagement ahead of putting something in place.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the idea was solid and on solid footing, but maybe the execution was lacking. I'm thinking about like the Benefine system that happened several years ago, you know, even the pension reform that happened all of last year, the Medicaid waiver. A lot of these things are kind of like almost haphazardly implemented. So, hopefully it works. I mean, it's certainly something that I would cheer for, because I do think we need better, more social workers to be working for the state and people who are well paid to do that work. So hopefully it does work out. But
yeah. And again, even people who go through this program, at the end, they're not social workers, because that requires an actual college degree.
Right.
So
they're just working in the social work sphere.
They're working, in the state social services sphere, which is great. We need more folks in there. But I just wonder if all the implications have really been thought about. For instance, the caseload, the extreme workload, is something that was touted as a reason to try to get more folks in. So then I think about who is supervising these apprentices. It's probably those people who already have an intense workload. And if you're supporting multiple people trying to train them and help them learn the system, like, that's actually just more work on you.
Right.
So just lots of elements that I wish were considered a little bit more.
So hopefully
the NASW has a good conversation with the DCBS commissioner,
whoever that is.
I forget her name. I had it a second ago, but hopefully comes out with, you know, some more answers, and we can try to see how this goes. But again, just tons of questions for folks. And one thing to note too, I do appreciate that social workers have gotten, you know, state social workers have gotten raises, and that more attention is being paid to there. But one thing that I think is important to note is that the social work profession is very rooted in social justice. So while we, you know, care about our profession and should be making enough to live on, you know, looking at what else has happened under this administration and with the General Assembly in terms of social justice issues has not made it better for social workers.
Right.
So the stuff that's going on with Medicaid, for instance, like,
absolutely,
that's just making it harder for social workers.
Absolutely.
For instance, so taking, you know, I appreciate some of the things that this administration has done regarding social work, but if we look at social work as the more well-rounded social justice focused profession that it is, there's lots of things that they could be doing better.
Yeah, absolutely. Beth, we're super glad to have your expertise on this issue and to have you talking about it. So yeah, it's definitely something we'll continue to track, but yeah, that seems like there's just as many questions. And even having, you know, pre-social worker here.
Yeah. so many questions, y'all.
Yes, lots of questions. All right. Well, before we go, let's have some quick hits. So this is a funny story that happened this week. A high school valedictorian at a Catholic school in northern Kentucky was told by the diocese up there that he could not give his speech, which focused on social justice. I think one quote I saw said it went against the teachings of the church. So he got a bullhorn and gave the speech outside of graduation, which I thought was a good
heck
move.
Yeah,
pretty cool move for that kid. Okay, Senator Mitch McConnell and Congressman Hal Rogers, two Republicans from Kentucky, they are working on federal legislation which would make the Mill Springs Civil War battlefield into a national park. The Battle of Mill Springs, if you aren't aware of it, it is a it was the site of the first Union victory in 1862, which would have been the second year of the war. It's currently being preserved by a nonprofit association and volunteers who are having to raise a lot of money. So federal protection for this historic site is something that these two guys are working on. It seems like it would be a cool thing.
And do you know where that is? I can't.
Yeah,
is
it's
Central
it's the
Kentucky,
it's the Cumberland Gap is where it is.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
it's down there. Yeah, they were in Eastern Kentucky. The Confederacy was trying to move up into this base, and the Union stopped them there. So Union victory. So always good to have those. Okay, Hal Heiner's replacement at the Education and Workforce Development Cabinet will be Derek Ramsey. We've just mentioned this earlier. Derek Ramsey is formerly the Labor Cabinet Secretary for Matt Bevin. So he was a Labor Secretary. He's moved to the Education and Workforce Development Cabinet. Mr. Ramsey, he played quarterback for the University of Kentucky in the 1970s. Was actually like super good at football. Kentucky was actually really good at football in the 70s, believe it or not. You can look it up. I know people don't believe that. And another thing about Mr. Ramsey is he's African-American, which means that the education secretary and the chair of the State Board of Education are both African-American. There's cynical and non-cynical ways to interpret that, and I'll let you do whatever one you want to. Beth, you wrote a quick hit. Tell us about the last one.
So it's all of this from Joe Sonka from Insider Louisville. So earlier today, the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky announced that it is partnering with Governor Bevin's administration to help implement the state's new Medicaid waiver program. And they say this is in an effort to ensure that no one loses coverage under these new work requirements. And those have been talked about on this show before. I'm sure you guys are familiar with those. And Ben Chandler, the president and CEO of the foundation, and also former Kentucky congressman, out of the 6th congressional district, who actually voted against the ACA.
And he voted for it. He did both. It was, it was all over the place. This was back in the time when the Republicans were like bringing it up for a vote every 5 minutes.
So it's okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, now he's really in the thick of things. So
yes, absolutely.
So Chandler said that his organization would assist people in paying premiums, meeting work or community engagement requirements, and also advancing health and financial literacy. Chandler said that the foundation would help facilitate a statewide feedback program on the waiver rollout to identify best practices and lessons learned.
Right.
So still a lot to learn about this. It'll be interesting to see what comes of it.
Yeah. This is an interesting development because, I mean, on one hand, you know, the Foundation for Healthy Kentucky was instrumental in the Medicaid expansion in the first place. They did a lot of work to build Connect and all that sort of stuff. So they were pretty upset when it all went away under the Bevin administration. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, you know, if they do implement this waiver, somebody needs to be there for people to help them make sure they don't lose their benefits. So it's definitely an interesting and difficult position for the foundation to be in. But I think this is probably, you know, somebody's got to be helping people to make sure they don't lose their benefits if Kentucky decides to do something stupid. So
yeah, and it's good too that they're working to try to get some input from how the rollout happens. But one thing to note too is that Kentucky Voices for Health had put forward a proposal earlier this spring that was rejected by the Bevin administration to create a stakeholders advisory council to help implement these changes. So it seems like they're taking like pieces of what was a good idea and maybe putting it over here.
Yeah.
It'll just be interesting to see what comes of that. And especially when we think about those lawsuits that are happening.
Yep.
What comes from this program, depending on how those turn out.
Yeah, and you listen to the show because you said lawsuits. Kara was very insistent that they were multiple. All right, that's it for us here. Let's listen to our interview with the folks from the Poor People's Campaign. Okay, Tana Fogel and David Miller are organizers with the Poor People's Campaign in Kentucky. The Poor People's Campaign is a movement that was inspired by the campaign of the same name, led by Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, which sought economic justice for poor people. The modern iteration is chaired by the Reverend William Barber of North Carolina and has chapters all across the country. Tana Fogel and David Miller, welcome to my Old Kentucky podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, guys, so the National Poor People's Campaign has released a set of demands. They really span a very wide variety of issues. It goes all the way from like statehood in the District of Columbia to reimplementation of the Voting Rights Act. So which of the demands is the Kentucky chapter the most focused on?
Oh, wow. We've been working on a lot of the demands, but, you know, we have a poor healthcare system, I would say, and we do know that there's been voter suppression. So, David, what would you weigh in on?
Well, I think maybe the themes of our weekly speak outs and actions kind of might be where Kentucky is focusing on. We began the week of May 13th talking about somebody's hurting our people, children, poverty, women, and people with disabilities. The next week, our focus was linking systemic racism and poverty, including voting rights, immigration, and mistreatment of indigenous communities. This week, we focused on the war economy. Next week, on ecological devastation and the right to health. The week after that, education and jobs. And after that, a week in which we talk about how organizing is a new and unsettling force. So while we may have a wide variety of demands, I think we focus them in on just a few areas in Kentucky, at least.
And that is really strong in the way that we are galvanizing and organizing around different things, with part of all of the work that's leading up to June the 23rd, which we will have caravans coming across 30 to 41 states headed back to Washington, D.C., where we will march on Washington. Something like what Martin Luther King did in 68 as he was collecting people and bringing people together. What we do know is that the government has been very successful with dividing the people of this nation as well as the people in Kentucky, whether it be by color, by gender, by economic status. And so we try to home in on all of the issues, which we have ecological devastation, we have poverty, militarism, systemic racism.
So you guys mentioned doing some actions in Frankfort. Could you talk a little bit more about what those actions have entailed and what other actions the Kentucky Poor People's Campaign have taken so far?
So David, if you'll take us backwards, I'll move us forward.
Okay, that sounds great. On our first week, I mentioned that the our theme was somebody's hurting our people, child poverty, women, and people with disabilities. We had a speak out in which we had different people from Kentucky, from different parts of Kentucky, and different demographics, particularly people who have been affected by policies that keep children and women in poverty and that adversely affect people with disabilities. We did that in the Annex Building across the street from the Capitol in Frankfort. And after the speak out, some people who have received specific training for nonviolent fusion direct action blocked the street between the Annex and the Capitol Building as a form of direct action to attempt to bring focus to these particular issues. The following week, I've already mentioned the focus, the emphasis was on linking systemic racism and poverty. There were, again, speakers, people who have been affected by systemic racism. And
voting rights.
And particularly, yes, voting rights, immigration, and mistreatment of indigenous communities. And as part, and that was taking place on the Capitol steps, and as part of the direct action, some of the people who were participating went into the Capitol Rotunda, and some of us who were attempting to go in were forbidden by the guard to actually enter into the Capitol building. And so some of those who went in decided that they were going to cover the statue of the Jefferson Davis that's in our rotunda, just to cover the disgraceful statue that is a memorial to institutionalized racism in our capital, and of course a memorial to the Confederacy and slavery.
Yesterday, our movement and our team was surrounded, of course, about our veterans, the lack of housing and homelessness that some of our veterans face. So we lifted up our veterans yesterday, and that was very, very powerful, a powerful moment. And we had speakers to come out. And then the gun violence, and we had students to speak. We had a young lady that spoke that was actually inside a school when shootings occurred. And so that was very powerful. David mentioned some of the pushback that we are receiving as we go to our house. And I call the Capitol our house because we vote people in and we vote people out, but it is supposed to be open to the citizens. And yesterday, they yellow taped us and put us in a small area. They also, the state had outhouses, the porta potties, to prevent us really from coming in to using the restroom. Then we were instructed that we can only enter by twos. And we stood there and we watched groups of people go in together into the Capitol for whatever purpose they were there for. But I believe that there's some type of discrimination. I'm pretty sure there's some rules or something that's being broken that will not allow us into our own Capitol. So that movement yesterday was phenomenal. We proceeded from the Capitol to the mansion, where we just stormed the gate. We went across the lines that they told us not to come across. But once again, I would like to reiterate that our movement is a nonviolent, direct moral fusion, a direct action. That is what we stand for. And I kind of got those out of order. So nonviolent, moral fusion, direct action is what we're taking. And lifting up poor people and lifting up this people, poor people's campaign, a national call for more revival. Over at the mansion, people laid out in the road, laid out on the steps, and we were chalked out as if we were dead. And then each person would call out something that they drew the person for, like, this is what has happened with lack of health care. We drew lines. The security was there, and that was very powerful. On Monday, June 4th, before David takes his position and answers more questions, we have done such wonderful organizing and with the Poor People's Campaigns, with a lot of different groups that joined in with us. Moms Demand Action, Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, the UAW, some teachers, and I'm pretty sure I hate starting the name because I'm going to leave a lot of people out, but we have had clergy to come down. And so on Monday, June the 4th, Reverend William Barber himself will come to Kentucky to participate in our action, and which, like David said, will center around ecological devastation and health care.
Sounds like you guys have been pretty busy.
Pretty busy.
So it sounds like a lot of these actions have been taking place in Frankfort. So wondering where across the state people are coming from to engage in these, and what are other ways that people can get involved? What might someone expect if they were to come on Monday?
People have been coming from all over the state. And, of course, we have pockets where we have more people. Largely because there are more people in some of those areas. Of course, we've had people come from the metropolitan areas of Louisville and Lexington. One of our tri-chairs, Megan Houston, the Reverend Megan Houston, is from Bowling Green, so we have had some great support from Bowling Green. I myself am from Barberville. I am the chaplain at Union College. And this is a faith stance for me, that my understanding of Christianity is that we advocate for the least of these. Poor People's Campaign, I think, is completely harmonious with that. And I think that's why so many people of faith, so many clergy, particularly inspired by Reverend Barber, have been coming out. We have definitely had people from Eastern Kentucky and Western Kentucky, the metropolitan
Northern Kentucky,
absolutely, the metropolitan areas of Northern Kentucky and Louisville and Lexington, and it has been amazing. So many different kinds of people from so many different areas in our state to come together to advocate for these positions that we believe are so important, not just for our state, but for the very soul of our nation, as Reverend Barber says.
So we've had some people from Indiana to come over. And when we say northern, and we can get specific, Covington area, Scott County, down in Georgetown, and I know that's Scott County, but you know they've got Georgetown and they've got Scott County. Mm-hmm. And so Harlan and Pikeville and, like he said, Louisville area, Shelbyville, the counties itself, Paris, Kentucky. So we could go on and on about different areas. But one thing we would like to note is that at the same time that we are doing our nonviolent demonstration and our speak out, 40 other states are doing it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on their time zones, but we are simultaneous. In everything that we do, we have the same things around the country. Everyone is marching one band, one sound.
One of the things that I heard you guys say when you were talking about the things and the actions that you guys had taken is that some of them were even though they're nonviolent, were pretty aggressive. Like you said, people were blocking the street, laying down in public space. You even said, I think you like stormed the gates of the governor's mansion. Talk to me a little bit about the use of these tactics. Why do you feel like they're a good fit for your movement? What do you hope to accomplish by using them? And what would you say to people who might get turned off by something like that?
One of the reasons that we have talked about and that we've been in training about is that policies is made in Frankfurt. The people who have the power, and we are going to take that power back one unit, the least of these, the people living in poverty. So it is important for us to go to the Capitol, to the people, even though they're not there. The question is, why aren't they there? Our state is broken. Why are you on recess when we have so many issues that need to be solved? Because there are 140 million people living in poverty. The National Poor People's Campaign did an audit, and that audit can be available to you all. It has been released. And there is the government would like for people to think there's only 40 million, which that's no small amount. But after the audit, it's 140 million. Reverend Barber says, if you are living from paycheck to paycheck, then you are living in poverty. And so we have been aggressive with our actions. We are just lifting up people who have been beaten down for so long, and we are doing actions that really pertain to some of Kentucky's poor policies that they passed in this last General Assembly. And so that's why it's so important that we're at the Capitol, that we keep the focus on our legislators are not here. They're home because they can afford to be home. They can afford to be on vacations. They are living the so-called American dream when the rest of us in Kentucky are, and I don't care what it says about the average of people unemployed versus people being employed, if they would look at the people being employed, it's not the poor people. It's not the people who may have a sordid background, who are citizens now and are trying to live a life. Those people are not included in that. And so it's so important to keep lifting up people who can't lift themselves up. Martin Luther King has a quote, and I'm going to misquote it, but the general consensus of that quote says, our Thurgood Marshall, about pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, but if you don't have a pair of boots to pull yourself up with, then where are you left? Mm-hmm. Where is it that you fit in? If you never had a pair of boots in the first place, you can't pull yourself up by the bootstraps.
I think I want to address the topic of aggressive tactics. Throughout the history of nonviolent direct action, whatever tactics have been taken has always been seen to be as too aggressive by somebody. Whether it's a march, whether it's a sit-in, whether it is a die-in, or whether it is someone raising their fist at the Olympics, there's always been somebody who said, that's just too far. And so we can see those kind of same things happening today. When Black Lives Matter protesters take the streets, somebody says, well, that's just too aggressive. And when NFL players take a knee, that's just too respectful. And it's the same kind of response. So I think that it is very important to look at what might be considered to be aggressive tactics, so always nonviolent tactics, in the context of two things. One is that in the spirit of Martin Luther King's organizing, he always insisted that everyone who participated in direct actions be trained. And as Reverend Barber talks about, we're contending for the soul of the nation. We also have to contend for our own souls in the sense that it is a spiritual matter, and we who are involved in nonviolent direct action look to ourselves, our interiors, and engage in whatever spiritual disciplines our own tradition have to illuminate within our own hearts the violence that's in our own hearts, and then do what we have to do to bracket that when we engage in those activities, so that when we engage in our nonviolent direct actions, we absolutely have a covenant with one another that whether somebody feels that it's aggressive, we're absolutely going to be nonviolent. Mm-hmm. And that's the first point. So in the context of being the spiritual successors of Martin Luther King's insistence that we look at our own hearts as well as the policies of our nation. But then second, I think our tactics have to be seen in the context of the violence that the systems of the United States already perpetrate against all of the peoples that we've talked about, all of the peoples on the margin. I, as a person of privilege, I'm a white Christian clergy person, and I'm educated, and so I have so much privilege. And I am the beneficiary of all of these policies that give me privilege after privilege at the expense of other people. And so I don't have to engage in any kind of individual violence to have all of these benefits that I have at the expense of others. The system does it for me. And so by our laws, by our war on the poor, by our war on people of color, the so-called the war on drugs that just becomes privatized imprisonment, our actions, though they may seem aggressive to some, are just a nonviolent counterpoint to the violence that the system does to people every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and it seems like your organization is doing a lot of good. And it seems like you guys are getting out there and getting seen and getting heard. And it certainly seems like you've gotten the attention of Dr. Barber, who's coming to visit you guys. So congratulations on that. Thank you guys both so much for joining us this week.
Thank you.
We would like to invite you out to that we meet on Mondays. It's like Moral Monday. We have three more Mondays, including the one on June 4th. And we would like to invite you all out to the event. Hopefully you will be able to make it there.
All right. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you all.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for listening, guys. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MyOldKYPod. You can find us on Facebook at MyOldKentuckyPodcast. We have a newsletter, tinyletter.com/MyOldKentuckyNewsletter. And you can give to us at Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/MyOldKentuckyPodcast, you can give us $1, $2 a month. Or whatever amount. It helps to support our hosting fees. And, you know, we do a lot of work. So if you want to throw some money our way, we would very much appreciate it. All right. I hope you enjoy the show. And we will see you guys next week.
Take care.